this afternoon. It gives me great pleasure to introduce a man that I've had the privilege of getting to know over the last couple of years. It's been a pleasure working with other veterans in need, and John is a Navy veteran, and he works with the West LA VA, helping other veterans in recovery. And you know, working with you, John, and getting to know you has been a real blessing. And getting to work with other veterans and helping them has been one of the highlights of my sobriety. And so with that, I want to introduce John to you, and then we're going to have Richard W. From Slow read a vision for you.
Hi everyone, I'm Richard. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Richard.
A vision for you, page 164 from the big book. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in the morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who's still sick. The answers will come. If your own house is in order, but obviously you cannot transmit something that you haven't got. So see to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is a great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the record of your past. Give freely what you've found and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge through the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then.
I'm John. I'm an alcoholic. And man, sorority got me all teary-eyed. I don't know how I got this life that I've got, but I'm very grateful. A new freedom and a new happiness. I've got a sobriety date. It's June 5th, 2016. I've got a sponsor. His name is Jim H. from Rancho Santa Margarita, and he knows everything I wish wasn't true about myself. And I'm really current with that man. And in fact, I just recently did an inventory, and took a look at myself again, as we tend to do. And I've discovered one thing: I'm still in construction, and that's okay. And I haven't arrived yet, which I'm so glad that this isn't the arrival. But thank you for asking me to come up here. It's been such a beautiful spiritual experience coming up here. Paula has kind of contacted me. Mansoor gave her my number, and she contacted me. I'm not sure. You had Father Tim last year, and he's a dear friend of mine. And I think he might have put in a good word for me, too. I've never been the veteran speaker. I've spoken before about my alcoholism, but it adds a little bit more of an oomph, especially up here with my brothers. And I look out over this group, And I'm just honored to be there and be asked to. And the committee has been so amazing. The speakers that have come already that we've had, I could have gone home after hearing Guy and Debbie. And Debbie really cracked my heart open. First of all, I'd like everybody, in honor of Dr. Paul, to, he wrote on page 420 in the book that his serenity and his expectations were, like, inversely proportional. So I'd like everybody to lower their expectations of me. And I'm looking out for your serenity, so I'm being very unselfish. But in order for you to maintain your serenity, lower your expectations of your speaker. I grew up in New York, just outside of New York City. I grew up not far from Stepping Stones, where Bill and Lois's home was. And that's got nothing to do with me coming to find you guys. I didn't know it existed. I knew AA existed because my sister got sober at a very young age, and that's an alcoholic. I told my sister the reason I hung on so long and stayed away from these rooms is her fault. And she kind of understands that now, but she just recently took 41 years, and you people showed up at my father's funeral 20 years ago. You know, he was an AA guy, and they tried to get me into meetings, and they got me in the parking lot one time, and somebody gave me a hug and said, "Oh, you're John," and I never went in. That freaked me out a little bit. So I held out as long as I could. Irish, Catholic, Italian family. My mother's Italian, my father's Irish. I was the first male born from the first male. So you'd think the second coming of Christ was born when I was born. So when people say they felt a little different, I felt different because I was told I was different, you know. My grandfather was Postmaster General of Newark, New Jersey, and never went anywhere without his flask or his Fleischmann's. His cousin was Governor of New Jersey, so screw the Kennedys, here come the Cahills. That was the feeling that there was some expectations placed on me at a very young age. My grandfather, I was his joy, and I never really understood that until I got a grandson. But he would finish his bottle of Fleischmann's and he'd say, "Come on, I'm taking my grandson for a walk," and we go down to the bar, and I'd sit on this same bar. Year after year, and I'd eat pistachio nuts and I'd drink cherry cokes, and I'd watch him hold court, and I knew, man, that was going to be me someday. I wanted to be him. You know, everybody listened to every word he said, and I'd go home, my fingers were all red, and my lips were all red from the pistachio nuts, and I knew one day I was going to be able to hold court like that, you know. And Irish wakes. And I think my first drink was at an Irish wake. I was probably nine years old, you know, and I was at an Irish wake and somebody handed me a flask and that whiskey. Oh, there you are, Paul. I talked about you. I don't know if you were here. Were you right there? Okay, I know. I talked about you. I said great things about you. Sorry, I got distracted. But, I knew I was going to hold court in bars. I think I was like 11 years old when my father got caught cheating on my mother with one of her friends. You know, they'd have martini parties at night. My father was a brilliant staff scientist for IBM there in Westchester, New York, and he also did real estate on the side, and they'd have these martini parties. And I remember being like totally in love with the onions, the cocktail onions, you know. Now, I didn't know that these things probably soaked up a good amount of gin, that or the olives. So I would eat the everybody's onions and olives to the point where I was this little kid with some serious stomach issues. And I didn't know about the phenomenon of craving, but I was craving these cocktail onions and these olives at a very young age. And things were going well for our family until my father got caught cheating, and then there was a lot of a lot of chaos. Right about that time, my sister's alcoholism, she started to try to commit suicide. My father was out of the house, and you know, I was kind of sent to spend some time with some friends, family friends, and I was sexually assaulted or abused by a man, and about 6 months later I was sexually abused by a woman. And that's got nothing to do with my alcoholism. It's just got to do with some things that started out at a young age. In order to, you know, a picture of a boy that was confused and kind of alone and unprotected. You know, I've done a lot of work on this outside of AA, but I think I never would have been able to even say that from the podium if it wasn't. One time I said it from the podium, and a young man came up to me, and I was like, you want to get my number? Like, let's talk. He's like, no, I need to talk to you. And I'm like, well, what? It's what? He goes, no, can I talk to you in private? He said, me too. You know, and he said, I'm going to tell somebody tomorrow. And I don't know. I think when we tell our stories, when I tell you about my brokenness and your brokenness, and they kind of meet, and there's some healing that goes on. And I think that was the first time that some healing went on. And I'll move on from that, but I think it's important to see where this young boy, that before he really started to drinking, where he was at. And shortly after that, I started to get a hold of alcohol. You know, it was back when, you know, we could get a hold of alcohol. You know, it's not like nowadays where it's difficult. We could always sit outside of a liquor store and pay somebody. There were bars in New York City where we could drink at a very young age. They just cared if you had money. So drinking became a common occurrence. It became, you know, something that we did, something that was a birthright in my family, and something that I knew I was going to do forever. It was going to be a great part of my life. And it was a lot of fun. And there wasn't too many consequences. You know, the cops looked out for us. It seemed like they'd take our beer and pour it out, or they'd take our liquor. But there were never charges. There were a couple of cars that I totaled, you know, driving drunk, and never any consequences. And as I look back, I was like, wow, there was a lot of stuff that happened. You know, stuff that we did to our families. I didn't, you know, last night when Debbie was talking about how, you know, how Guy's alcoholism killed her dreams, killed her hopes, and killed her spirit, I started to think about what I did to my family. And it's just, you know, we don't always realize what we do. And I guess that's just a tangent. I had to say something about how I'm feeling. I'm very emotional this weekend. I went out to that Morro Rock, and there's some sort of spiritual vortex going on out there. I did a meditation out there, and it was really powerful. There's something going on out there. There's something going on here, because, you know, I walked through the things. I think I met my friend Marty. Where's Marty? Marty's my newcomer guy. He's like, yeah, he's like, I'm out there, you know, shaking hands, and I love you, Marty. You're the most important person in this room, brother. And I know you don't realize it. Marty just took 30 friggin' days. And I don't know if Tony's with you. And Tony took 7 days, and I'm like, wait, I'm doing the math. I'm like, you mean you stayed sober last weekend? He's like, yeah. I'm like, holy shit. Yeah, oh, there, Mary, yeah. Mary was worried. She's like, I haven't heard anybody curse. And I was like, all right, Mary, I'll take care of that for you. So we can check that off. So growing up in New York was one thing. I had some things happen to me. I discovered, you know, alcohol and drugs, marijuana. It wasn't like it was today, but marijuana was a thing. And I discovered PCP, and I was going down to New York City and chasing after that. I was chasing after anything that would change John, you know, change me from the inside, where I didn't care and I could escape from who I thought I was, or who I thought, you know, who I didn't want to be, who I didn't want to feel, you know. So I would numb out everything. I ran around, did a bunch of geographics, you know. I graduated high school and then moved to Hawaii. I was in Waikiki and living in Ala Moana Park for a little while and working and handing out ticket and tour things and going on the booze cruises because we worked for them. And I saw Don Ho sing Tiny Bubbles a number of times, like hammered on Mai Tais, you know. I always thought he should invite me up there to sing with him, but he never did. And you know, my Super Bowl Sunday, my friend and roommate severed his arm in a trying to walk through a plate glass window, and it was like, let's go back to New York, and went back to New York, and that wasn't working. I got a job in the garbage business. I got family in the garbage business. If you know, you know. And with that kind of job, you know, you were drinking in the bars early in the morning because you get off work about 9 a.m. And I was riding with one of my friends, and we got into a head-on collision. And I'm pretty sure he hurt himself and he hurt some other people, but I just kind of stumbled away and said, man, I got to get out of New York. I knew I was going to get put in jail. I knew something was going to happen if I didn't leave. And I went to, my father had moved to Virginia, so I moved to Virginia. I started hitchhiking to the road. I got a job waiting on tables. And that was pretty interesting and a lot of fun. I could, you know, bullshit some people. I had a good amount of knowledge of food and wine. And I heard about this job at this famous restaurant, you know. And this place called the Inn of Little Washington. It was right down the road from my father's house. And they took a chance on me at 19 years old. I think I was 19 years old, and they took a chance on me. And I waited on the food editor for the New York Times, and this thing came out, and we had to buy a helo pad to land cars. And I started making a ton of money as a very young kid. And I was, you know, waiting on sitting presidents and superstars and sports stars, and man, I thought it was the thing. And I started to, you know, I started to realize that it was hard work waiting on tables, and I didn't want to do that. But this guy walked around with this little tasting thing, and he got to drink wine like during work. And I was like, man, that's, what's your job? He's like, sommelier. And I was like, that's a cool job. And it was something that I aspired to be, you know. It was like, so I started studying wine, and it gave me the ability to come into work hungover and have a few drinks, you know, and it to be cool, you know. It's like, that's what we do. We walk around and we have a couple of drinks. And I did that for a number of years. I met a really nice girl. She didn't drink, she didn't curse, and perfect for me. And I got her pregnant, and then I married her. That's how we do it in my family. And good Catholic boys do that. So I married her, and her father was not happy. I can't imagine why, but her father was not happy. But he did give us a place to live. And we moved down to Clearwater, Florida, and I got a job working in St. Pete at this big hotel. And I went, they belonged to a charismatic Pentecostal church, and I knew I had to do something. So I went to the altar, and I got down on my knees, and I gave my life to Christ. And man, the goose hung high for quite some time. I think about a month and a half into that, I hadn't had a drink, and I'm playing pool with the guys that I wait tables with, and I'm still studying as a sommelier, and the guy says, you can't just have a beer with us, because I'm drinking Coca-Cola. And I said, well, yeah, I could probably have one beer. I think it took about 3 days, and I remember I was sitting on a boat at the Skyway Bridge where the Tampa Bay empties out to the Gulf of Mexico. And I've got a bag of powder that keeps me awake, and I've got Southern Comfort, and I'm shark finning. And if you know shark finning, it's one of the worst, horrible things you can do. You're catching sharks, you're cutting off their fins for the black market for this shark fin soup. And then you're throwing the shark back in the water with no fins, and the other sharks are coming to feed, and then you catch them, and it's this hideous thing, and it's against federal law. It's really not aligned with any kind of integrity or moral values. And I knew I was going to get put in federal prison, and I knew I needed to do something drastic. So I went down to the recruitment office. And you know, I needed to stop drinking, so I signed up for the United States Navy. Makes sense, right? Makes sense. Yeah, hoorah, exactly. Kind of an institution that drinks, you know, it's famous for drinking. But it was pretty good for me. It gave me some structure. You know, we had a baby, and then shortly thereafter, we had another baby. My second daughter arrived at Travis Air Force Base in California. I was doing some training with some Marines out in Vallejo at this Mare Island installation. You know, life was pretty good. And then, you know, Saddam Hussein, you know, kind of invaded Kuwait, and things kind of changed. And I deployed. And during my deployment, I got a chance to make a phone call. We got some time off. I was doing VBSS. Although I'm considered a combat vet, I was doing pirate work. We were climbing up. We were taking ships down. We were climbing up sides of ships. UN sanctions. We had an oil embargo on Saddam Hussein, so we were in the Persian Gulf climbing up the sides of ships and taking down ships. And it was dangerous work, and granted, some people got severely injured, some people didn't make it. But it was relatively safe compared to some of my other veterans, that what they had to deal with. But thus the same, I got to a phone and I called my wife, and she said, I can't do this, I want a divorce. And I was in Fiumicino, Italy, which is not far from Rome. And I guess a few hours later, there are pictures to prove this, I'm standing just about half naked in the Trevi Fountain. And I'm talking to the Carabinieri, which is like the FBI of the Italian government. And it was this legendary story that still they talk about like it was a great thing. And now they built a thing. You can't even get in the Trevi Fountain anymore. So apparently they built something to keep drunken Americans, naked Americans out of skinny dipping in the Trevi Fountain. But that was the kind of I was just out of control, but it seemed like I would always get away with it. I jumped off bridges and did some crazy stuff. And the guys would say, we came home from the Gulf War, and there was parades. We couldn't pay for drinks. You know, it wasn't like my Vietnam brothers that came home to horrible, you know, demoralization. We came home to celebrations. And I remember there were drinks were on the house, and I said, give me a picture of kamikazes. And the guy gave me a picture of kamikazes, and he said, how many glasses? And I said, nope. And I said, that'll do. And I think I drank two pitchers of kamikazes that night. I fell down. The next day was Easter Sunday. And I remember seeing my daughters, and they were all dressed up in their Easter dresses. And I looked at my wrist, and it was broken in about seven places. And I couldn't take my daughters to Easter Mass, you know. And that disappointment that I would see year after year on my children's face, that was the beginning of it, you know. And, you know, I laughed it off time after time after time. And this went on for a long time. My naval career spanned 10 years. Towards the end of it, I was teaching a classified NATO secret course, and I was drunk constantly. I was also under the influence of other products, and I knew I was going to get put into federal prison if I got caught. And it kind of forced me out of the military. Shortly thereafter, 9/11, I grew up in New York. I watched these towers being built, and I remember the feeling that I had, you know, watching those towers go down and knowing that. I went to the recruitment office one time, and they said, sir, please, you got to leave, because I could barely walk. And I was showing up to the recruitment office drunk, trying to sign up again, and trying to go defend my country again. I couldn't draw a sober breath long enough to go to boot camp. I think boot camp the first time was my first detox. Now that I think of it, you know, everybody has a rough time at boot camp, but I think I didn't have a seizure, but pretty close to it. So 9/11 happens. I'm in and out of the. Now I've left. I'm in the restaurant business. I'm working for an amazing restaurant in Virginia, and I get a job as a sommelier for the Ritz-Carlton, you know. Again, my dream job. So I moved to Naples, Florida. My family's, I moved my daughters down to real close to me there so we could spend some time together. And they got to see me, you know, they could tell you where all the happy hour food was. A lot of people would say, oh my God, your little girls play pool so well. You must have a pool table. And I'm like, no. They learned that in bars. And they could tell you where each, everywhere you could get, you know, happy hour food, where there's wings here and there's, you know, hot dogs there and there's, you know, pigs in a blanket or whatever. So that was a common occurrence. My children grew up in bars, kind of like I did. You know, I made a lot of money. I had a house, and I rented out a couple rooms to guys. I'm going to fast forward a bunch because there was a lot of debauchery, a lot of drinking. It started to get really bad. I would get pancreatitis, and then they would give me Demerol or they'd give me Oxycontin. So now I am, you know, taking these high-powered sedatives and drinking, you know. Or taking the sedatives until the point where I was well enough to drink again. And then I'd start out slow, you know, hey, we're going to slow down a little bit. I was probably from the rich food that chef was cooking. It was from all the cream sauces, you know. I would walk around in my suit and people would say, oh my God, your breath is so cinnamony. You know, I'm like, oh, here, would you like an Altoid? I had Altoids, cinnamon Altoids. But the fact was, is I was drinking about a bottle of Fireball a night. You know, while I was tasting wine, until I could get off work and drink the way I wanted to. I remember I get off work and I get to the bar, and you know, you kind of get relief before the drink gets to you. And I was a tequila guy, you know, Don Julio, 1942. You know, I can't be a drunk. I'm drinking the good stuff. And I remember it would take me about three drinks, and then I'd be able to look at the mirror behind the bartender, and I would look at myself, and I'd smile, because I was present. I wasn't thinking about the past, and I wasn't thinking about the future. It didn't take long of me continuing to drink. You know, I heard somebody in a meeting one time it talked about this phenomenon of craving, you know, and it wasn't a phenomenon for me because it happened every time. So I didn't understand the phenomenon part of it. But this guy talked about getting thirstier. He got thirstier as he drank, and that was me. I'd drink, you know, I'd sip, you know, a nice double pour of tequila and sip on a Corona. And you know, the first hour I'd probably drink two shots and one beer. And then the second hour I'd drink three shots and three beers. And then the third hour I'd drink six shots and no beers. And then it was on. And it was whatever. You know, I was like, I was up for it all. I was like, boom, what did I just take? And it was just, and after hours party was always at my house. Rent was always paid late, but my roommates would always pay on time. And it was always interesting. So I wasn't a great guy. I was a real taker. So now I'm hooked on everything, and I can't draw a sober breath, and I don't need to because I'm at work, you know, and it's cool because this is what we do at this work. And Memorial Day was always a rough day. You know, I had survivor's guilt. So May 30th, 2016, I started drinking pretty heavy. You know, by June 2nd, by June 3rd, I'm trying to figure out how to kill myself. I'm trying to figure out how to kill myself but still look cool, you know. My neighbor had a lawnmower and a gas can by the side of his house, and I was thinking, you know what? I'm going to light John and Mary's house on fire. You know, I'm going to kick down the door. I'm going to go in and I'm going to save John and Mary because they're great, great neighbors. They're really nice people. Then I'm going to go back in for the dogs. They had these two Irish setters. You know, I'm going to go back in for the dogs. And then they had this sunken living room. They had two ficus trees, and they had a mirror. And I'll talk about mirrors a lot. I hated mirrors. You know, I could not look myself. I would look at my hair, I'd look at my teeth, I'd look at my shave, you know, but I couldn't look myself in the eye unless I had, you know, that right amount of alcohol. And And I would run into that mirror as fast as I could, knock myself out, and I would die in that fire. But I would die a hero. They'd probably give my daughters a folded flag. They might even name the street after me. This shit's going to be good. This is how I need to go out, you know? And that thought was, you know, supplanted by, you know, I think the dealer arrived and, you know, I still had alcohol left. Well, let's wait until it's all gone before I do this, you know? So I kept, you know, kept on drinking. I think it was June 4th. I'm playing with my 45, and I'm popping around in and popping in my mouth, and then popping it out, and kind of playing, and I took the 45 and I smacked myself in the teeth, and I went over and I thought I might have chipped my tooth, you know, I was really worried about how I'd look after I blew my brains out, so I looked in the mirror and I saw my eyes, and it was shell. It was empty. You know, I remember, I always hear Quinn's voice from Jaws. If you remember the old movie Jaws, and he's like, it's like a doll's eyes, you know, and it was death. And it looked like a doll's eyes. It was nothing. It was empty. It was soulless. And it was looking back at me. And I think that was when I had my first unselfish thought. In a very long time, if not forever. And I was like, I haven't walked Caitlin down the aisle. I can't do this. I haven't walked my daughter down the aisle. And I can't do that to her. And right then, a knock at the door, right? And I've been talking with the crisis hotline, the VA crisis hotline, for a couple of days. I had given my friend's name. I gave him Mo's name and number, and Mo had come over to get my weapons, you know, to take my weapons. And Mo said, you're going to treatment. I said, good idea. I said, that's a good plan. I said, next week I'll go to treatment. And he's like, no, you're going today. He's like, you're going today. I'm like, no, dude, it's very, you know, I got to get to work. They're like, work doesn't want you. Work is like, take him to the airport. So, and Mo said, we're going to fight. And Mo was bigger than me. He was younger and he was a lot stronger. He would have beat the shit out of me. And I said, well, okay, where am I going? And they're like, California. I'm like, well, summertime, California. Okay, that should be okay. And you go into treatment at West Coast Recovery. It specializes for veterans. I'm like, cool. But first you're going to a detox in Encino Medical Center, this place called Serenity. And I'm like, okay. And I said, okay. And I don't know who, I kind of said, who said that? Because I don't say okay to help. It was like another voice said okay. And I know it was surrender or grace. My sponsor calls it grace, a moment of grace. But I don't know where that came from, but I said okay. And I got on the plane. I don't remember much for that flight. I remember getting off the flight and there was a guy with my name, you know, and he had a Cadillac Escalade, and it was like, yeah, I'm going to my, you know, this is going to be, I'm going to talk to my agent, I might be in the movies, I'm going to California, you know, I'm sure I told some bullshit story to somebody on the plane, and I checked into this detox, you know, and it's this amazing detox, it's private rooms, and I had really good insurance, and they come in and they ask, what do you want to eat? And they're serving me food. And then they said, woke me up and they said, Mr. Kale, would you like to go to a meeting? I'm like, no, I don't want to go to a meeting. I'm watching ESPN, you know? It's like, this is important shit. And they're like, well, you had a seizure last night. Would you like to go to a meeting today? And it's an AA meeting. It's in the ice cream room. And I'm like, ice cream room? They said, yes. They said, if you go, you get a pack of cigarettes. I'm like, wait a second, I'm in a hospital. They're like, well, a behavioral tech will take you in a wheelchair, take you down to the smoking area, and you can smoke down there. And I didn't have any cigarettes. I smoked my last cigarettes after the airport, and I knew I was in California, so I was like, nobody smokes in California. And they said, I said, do you have Marlboro Red Box? And they said, yes. I said, where's my robe? And I went to my first H&I, my first meeting. It was in the ice cream room. I had strawberry shortcake. And my grand sponsor, Jay S. from Sedona, he talks about mysticism and AA. And I look next to me, and my father's sitting next to me, just as clear as Mary's sitting right there, and he's smiling at me. And I don't know, it's called the kiss. He says it happens a lot. It's when somebody that was in AA that's passed is there to kind of welcome you. And I thought I was having, you know, some sort of vision. I knew something was happening, you know, right then. And it was freaked me out a little bit. And it took me a long time to tell anybody. I think it took me about a year into sobriety before I told my sponsor. And my sponsor said, talk to your grand sponsor. And it said, talk to Jay. So, and Jay said, yeah, that's quite common. I said, well, how can I make this happen again? He's like, oh, you're an alcoholic. Yeah, you're not satisfied with one. You want another. Yeah, you want another spiritual experience. He goes, why don't you get into the book and get one there on page 567? You know, spiritual experience. So I go to detox. I'd like to say something more happened at that meeting, not much more. And then they send me out to Hemet, California, to West Coast Recovery, which doesn't specialize in veterans. There's a lot of young kids, and it's summer of 2016. It's triple digits. It's brutal, and I'm going through treatment. And they're teaching up on the board, and there's this one teacher, and she's absolutely stunningly beautiful. She's tatted up. She's got jet black hair, and she's got blue eyes, and she's teaching DBT. And I call it diabolical behavioral therapy, but she's teaching DBT, and there's these young guys, and they're causing a mess. And I'm like, hey, why don't you be quiet? Everyone's, you know, we're trying to listen. And she's like, it's okay, Silver. She called me Silver Fox. I love that. So you know. And they started goofing around again, and I'm like, hey, shut the hell up, you know, go outside, you're disturbing the whole class. And I think they said something else, and I got up and I pushed my desk. I was pissed, and I looked at them, and I wanted to physically assault them, and they looked really scared. So I said, I'm going for a walk. And I went for a walk, and I came back towards the end of class, and she said, okay, that's the end of class, you guys take a 15-minute break and then come back. She goes, everyone except for you, I want to talk to you, Silver Fox. And I was like, yes, this is my moment. You know, this is, you know, she's going to thank me. You know, we're going to fall in love. You know, I'm going to live in Hemet, California for the rest of my life. I'm ready. And she looks at me. She gets really close to me. She said, you're a tequila cocaine guy, right? And I'm like, yeah, whatever you got, you know. And she's like, did anybody ever come up to you and grab your tequila off the bar and drink it? I'm like, oh, no. She goes, did anybody ever grab the mirror and straw and snort a line without your permission? I'm like, no. And she looked at me really serious, and she said, well, why are you being such a bitch now? I was crushed. I was like, what? And she said something that I'll never forget. She said, your serenity is the most powerful thing you own, the most valuable thing you own. She goes, don't ever let anybody take it away from you, and definitely don't give it away. And it was, you know, it was a hard lesson, but it was such a good lesson. That's all I learned from 30 days of treatment. But they said, do you want to go to an IOP, an intense outpatient? And I'm like, no, I'm not going to fall for this shit. And they said, it's in San Clemente, California. And I said, give me my phone and give me the address. They gave me the address, and it was this place called Pacific Palms Recovery. It was only about a mile and a half to the ocean, to the water. And the water is spiritually a place for me to get regenerated, especially salt water. And I said, okay, I can go there. And I went there, and I put me in a house with 17 millennials. And we had bunk beds, and they didn't know how to cook. They didn't know how to clean. They didn't fold their own laundry. They didn't know. They listened to horrible rap music. They didn't know who Grandmaster Flash was. They never roller skated. They were very upsetting. But those young men saved my life. You know, I walked down to this place called the Hardcore Harbor. If you don't know about it, it was this great morning meeting from 7 a.m., I couldn't sleep at night, and these young guys that were in the front house, they all had big books, and they came in at like 5:30 in the morning. I'm in the back smoking cigarettes, and they're like, "Sir, you want to go to a meeting?" I'm like, "No, I don't want to go to a meeting." So like, come on, we go down there and we set up chairs. It's in the harbor. And then I'm like, "The harbor?" I'm like, "On the water?" They were like, "Yeah." And I can hear Otis Redding singing to me, you know, on the dock of the bay. I'm like, "Okay, I can do that." You know, so I went down there. I got my first AA resentment. This guy, Paul, I was putting the chairs like a half inch off. And he's like, "No, that's not how we do it here." And I was like, "Screw you, I'm outside." And then in the middle of the meeting, these two guys almost get into a fist fight. This guy, Jeff, and this other guy. Jeff hates that I tell this story. But these guys, one guy was saying, "I'll cover your commitment." But then he had his sponsee do it, and his sponsee didn't have 6 months. And that's, you have to have 6 months to do this commitment. And these guys are throwing down. I mean, these guys are, F you, come on. They're pushing each other in the middle of the thing. And then some girl was talking about being inappropriate in a parking lot with a boy. And I forget what else happened. Some guy was talking about Jesus, and somebody said, "We don't talk about Jesus here." And I was like, "This place is amazing." I mean, yeah, I mean, life is boring, but AA is not boring. This is exciting. So the next day when those four guys came in, you know, I'm like, "Where you guys been? We going to the meeting?" And that's, you know, I came just to watch you guys. And you guys said to pray. You know, you guys, there was one guy who said, "I did the third, seventh, and 11th step prayer. You know, in the prayer of St. Francis," or he didn't say that, but I ended up finding this 11-step prayer, and it wasn't the prayer of St. Francis. It was, "God direct my thinking so that it'd be empty of self-pity, dishonesty, self-will, self-seeking, and fear." So I would read these, the third-step prayer, I'd read it every morning, you know, and I was like, "I'm going to do this, you know, like I did the military, the best of my ability, and we'll see, you know, how it comes out. I don't think it's going to work for me. You know, I'm different. I'm different from you." And you know, I'd like to challenge the newcomers. I hope you hear something that keeps you coming back, but I hope you hear something that even challenge you out of spite to do the steps. I did the steps fully controlled, like, screw you. It's not going to work for me. I'm not stoked to be sober. I'm from New York. You know, I'm not stoked. Everyone's stoked to be sober. You know, I'm not stoked to be shit. My mental health fell off like a ski jump after, right at, you know, when I put down the stuff, I got sicker. So I started doing these prayers. You know, I made my bed, and then I finally got a sponsor, and God's got a sense of humor, so he sent me this guy who went to the Naval Academy. He's like, "I went to the Naval Academy." And I'm like, "Oh, I beat you up in high school." And he was like, "Right now I'm unemployed, so we can do this every day." And it was like, yay. You know, he was like, "You see that asterisk? Let's go to page 567. I'm like, "Oh, come on. You know, it's like, let's finish this chapter," and stuff like that. And that man saved my life. I would complain to him, and he'd listen. He'd just listen. And then he'd say, "Are you done with your pity party?" He's like, why don't you fold those guys' socks?" I'm like, "What?" He goes, "Fold those guys' socks. The guys you're complaining about not folding their laundry, fold it for them." So I started folding their laundry, but I didn't tell them. I was like, mission impossible. I was folding their laundry and not telling them. They're like, "Who folded my laundry?" I'm like, "You know I didn't do it." They're like, "Yeah, old man, we know you didn't do it, you grumpy old." Yeah, and then I go to the harbor, and then I cook them breakfast. I cook them all breakfast. I realized they didn't have to clean their own plates, so I'd clean their plates. And those men let me be of love and service. A number of those young men died in that house, overdose. We Narcan'd a few of them, and some of them didn't make it. But the ones that did are having kids now, careers, the ones that did the steps. So if you're a newcomer, or if you're new, or you need to even regenerate, I mean, at 10 years, I needed to do another inventory. I needed to get back in the steps. I just did a fear inventory, a sex inventory, and a resentment inventory, and it was revitalized me. You know, even though I constantly try to keep up with the steps, I needed to do that. what do I want to say about these young men and the men in my groups? I've got a home group. It's the South County Men's Stag Meeting. It's the beginners meeting. We meet on Tuesday nights. We used to meet at the hospital. Now we meet at a church. And that's about 100 guys. And I love those men. And those men love me. I love you. I, for those of you who know me, I love you. You know, Chris and Christina are here, and Chris gave me the honor of sponsoring him. It just happened to be that Christina is connected with the Al-Anon group up here, and he was like, I'm coming up there. And I'm going up to San Luis Obispo. I'm like, oh, cool. I hear the 12 o'clock speaker is a piece of shit. But he's like, what does that mean? I'm like, he's like, what? And, Christina and Chris allowed me to officiate their wedding. You know, and that doesn't happen for me. Those young girls are so proud of their dad now, and they're so grateful to AA for giving them their father. Gabrielle said, you know, Dad, Gabrielle just got her doctorate. She left this morning on a 200-mile backpacking trip. She's a doctor at UC Davis. She's brilliant. Skips a generation. My father was brilliant, too. I got the alcoholism gene. I didn't get the brilliance gene. She said to me, she said, Dad, she goes, when we were kids, you were our idol. You know, you were our hero. And she goes, you know, you are again. And, so when Paula or Mansoor says, you know, hey, can you come up and give a talk? I'm like, yes, you know, if anybody needs anything. I owe a debt to AA that I don't know if I'll ever repay, but I'm going to damn sure try. If you're new, try to find something. I found myself in this big book. You know, it's about me. I read it like it's about me. It's autobiographical about me. And I hope you find a chapter that's your favorite. Mine changes. It's like we agnostics now, and it might change. There's a spot in the big book, and I spent a lot of time in the water, there was a time in Haiti when there was a lot of people leaving Haiti and were ending up in the water, and we had to get in and save a lot of people. And if you've ever been around anybody that's drowning, it's amazing how strong they are and how scary it can be. But there's a spot in the big book, and it says, with all the desperation of drowning men, what seemed at first a flimsy reed turned out to be the loving and powerful hand of God. And, there's a lot of speakers that I would listen to, or people in my home group that were flimsy reeds for me, and I didn't believe it. And it turned out that I had a spiritual awakening, and I realized that God had been with me even through the tough times. That old corny Jesus footprints in the sand thing, because there was a time where I got sober pancreatitis, and I thought that, you know, your God's not showing up for me, you know, and somebody. Reminded me that my difficulties were that every time I had a problem, I would go drink. And they said, since you've been saying that prayer, you've had problems, right? And I'm like, yeah. And have you gone and drank? So God has taken away my difficulties. You know, this bondage of self, I can get relief if I upon awakening. You know, before I get my head off the pillow, I said, God, thank you for the air in my lungs. Show me who you want me to help. Show me how you want me to help them. And please make it obvious, because you know I'm a knucklehead. And then I get up, and I make my bed, and I say a few prayers and meditation. Meditation is the biggest thing in my life right now. The most important thing is for me to shut up and just be quiet and kind of be still. And I'm learning more and more on how to be still. The veteran thing, I'm proud of being a veteran. Believe me, I am proud of being a veteran. I help veterans for fun or for free, and I help veterans in my job. It's an honor, and it's an honor to be asked to become here as a veteran. Being a veteran, I'm so proud of, but I'm so much more proud of being a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. You saved my life. You've given me back my family, and I'll never repay that. I'm John. I'm an alcoholic.